Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Game Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rudolf Indest, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Alan Meads, the author of Arcade Britannia, a social history of the British amusement arcade from 2022. The publisher, by the way, is MIT Press. Before we jump right in, though, I would let you know that if you like our show, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the audio platform of your choice, and share this episode or the others with your friends. And now, back to the show. Today, we shall hear about the story of the British amusement arcade from the 1800s to the present. Arcade Britannia highlights the differences between British and North American arcades, especially in the terms of the complex relationship between gambling and amusements. Alan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, my name's Dr. Alan Meads. I'm a principal lecturer in games design at Canterbury Christchurch University. That's a university in the southeast of England. And I lead our games design provision, our undergraduate and postgraduate provision. And, well, I've grown up amongst seaside arcades, all my life. So, yeah, arcades run in my blood. Let's put it that way.
That's nice. That's very good. Well, of course, we have to check for your Ludo Street credibility then. Please tell us what's your favorite game and the one, or even the ones, you're playing right now. Or maybe it's even an arcade machine. Well, we don't know. Let's hear it.
Well, this is where I started to panic. When you asked me this question, I was thinking, I've got to think of something really cool to say.
So That's actually, just to interrupt you briefly right here, that's actually what most people say. They feel under pressure, but there's no pressure involved here, I promise you.
Phew. I'm not very cool, so that's good to hear the pressure's gone. So actually, I'd say probably my favorite game has to be Fallout 4. So I know that it's been ridiculed by many people, but it's the game I keep coming back to every time. Or perhaps it's Outrun. I don't know. I can't quite decide. But right now I'm playing, I tend to graze a couple of different games. So right now I'm playing Ghosts of Tsushima. I'm also playing Disco Elysium. I'm still playing Cyberpunk 2077. And the one that I've got just before I go to sleep at night is, of course, Fire Emblem Engage. So quite an eclectic mix of games there.
Right, yeah. Well, circling back to your book, where you are drawing on first-hand accounts of industry members and different sources, including rare pictures and trade publications. And it seems to me that thereby you are telling the story of the first arcades, the people who made the machines, the rise of video games, plus the economic challenges spurred by public fears of moral decline. So please tell our listeners, how did you come to write Arcade Britannia in the first place?
Yeah, thanks, Rudolph. Now, this is a bit of a strange one. So while I've been working in higher education for 20 years now, my path into university and research was a bit of an odd one. It was never something that I intended to do or I ever thought I had the capacity to do. So I grew up in the British seaside. I hung around in the arcades all day long, most evenings as well. So the arcades were the background to my life. Anyway, I ended up doing a PhD where I spent 5 years doing an ethnography of people hacking and glitching and modding games. And I became really interested in transgressive play. So I wanted to know about all these strange things that people did and the ways that they played in ways that were considered quite bad. So after doing my PhD, I then had a bit of a crisis, really. I thought, Do I want to keep doing research where I'm forming arguments all the time? Because it's quite difficult forming arguments. And instead, maybe I want to tell the stories of other people and kind of expose some things that that were unknown. And if I'm honest, first of all, I wanted to tell about transgression in the arcade, because when I was an adolescent growing up in the arcade, we got up to all kinds of shenanigans. Of course, there were gangs and there was fighting, and then, you know, there was cigarettes and alcohol sometimes. And so I associated growing up in the arcade with a mix of basic adolescent British kind of behaviors. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to do was find out if people knew that and if people could share their stories of transgression. Of course, when I started doing it, when I started reaching out to people, I produced a comic book where I did oral history accounts of people's playing arcades. Yeah. I shared them with people and I asked them to share their stories of transgression. And if I'm frank, those stories of transgression became pretty boring. They kept repeating the same things. But the thing that didn't make sense was the whole arcade edifice all around it. People didn't understand how the arcades ran, how the machines got there, where they'd started, the dynamics of the arcade. And what happened was very slowly I realized that there was a more important, essential story to be told that was quite different to, you know, the ideas of Tron or Stranger Things or anything like that. It was a very British story of the evolution and growth of the arcade. So that's the very long answer to your question, that I never intended to write that book, but it had to be written.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because I think in the public perception right now, especially where you're mentioning Stranger Things, right, this has been a really a big push in people's mind about the certain images of arcade culture in the States, right? But people obviously they know, but they don't trust their mind that obviously their very own country has an origin story or history of arcade machines and arcade really arcade life. Themselves, right?
Yeah, well I totally rally against the Stranger Things version of the arcade. You know, I in the book I call it the mythic arcade because I just don't think it's real. It certainly isn't real from a British perspective. I know it isn't real from a German perspective. It isn't real from an Australian perspective. And yeah, we have all these different regional stories of arcades and public play. And I don't really think it's real from a North American perspective either. I think it's a product of our times and more to do with selling the idea of the emergence of video games rather than any real arcades.
Yeah. Well, since the focus of our show is on digital games, I would love to focus on later chapters in your book. That being said, of course, it would be totally reckless and an outright shame to exclude your fantastic and historic throwback onto the social history of the British amusement arcade. And it should be clear that these chapters also deepen one's understanding for later developments. So let's have a look at the maybe first four chapters. Could you please guide us through them for our listeners?
Yeah, I think instead of doing a step-by-step, chapter-by-chapter, it might be better if I just discuss some of the themes that come out of those. Right. Because the first four chapters really try and establish a historic base for the discussion of the arcade. And what I do is I trace the history all the way back to, well, probably about 1100. So that might sound crazy, but we didn't have that many video games back then. But but what we did have was a community of traveling showmen. So in all of Northern Europe, you have communities of traveling entertainers, you know, that might be attached to circuses or menageries, and they would be traders and they would run fairs. And essentially this group of performers and entertainers would travel all the way around Northern Europe and all the way around the UK entertaining people. And what happened was that this group of people, they became a self-identifying cultural group in England called the Travelling Showmen. And they were part of a Travelling Showmen's Guild. Is they essentially became the most technologically advanced, the most, the most kind of technologically engaged people for entertainment. So these were the people that popularized amusement parks. Eventually they developed amusement parks and static amusement parks. They developed things like steam-driven rides, like merry-go-rounds and things like that. Yeah. And alongside these big, big rides, they would have sideshows. Now, that might be a simple game where you have to toss a ball into a hoop or something like that. But as technology advanced, that included mechanical games and coin-operated games. Mm-hmm. And essentially, this community were the ones that, when we get to about the late 1800s, have invested heavily in coin-operated machines, entertainments, and gambling machines. And this community really is the same community that, if you fast forward, you know, another 70 years, are the ones that established the British Amusement Arcade. Something else happens as well that's important is that after the Second World War, there was an enormous amount of redevelopment and building happening across the UK, and that included social changes. So whereas we had these travelling showmen who would travel all around the country, the showgrounds and places where they'd set up their fairs for nearly 1,000 years were, they were being removed and redeveloped as car parks or industrial sites and things like that. And the government essentially did whatever it could do to minimize and reduce the traveling showmen as a cultural group. Mm-hmm. And at that point, those showmen had the choice. If they wished to continue entertaining, they either had to become even more competitive or even more organized. But many of them saw the opportunities of becoming something called a sand dancer. Now, a sand dancer is a non-pejorative term, so it's just a term used by traveling show folk or traveling showmen to mean people that have decided to stop traveling and set up a static arcade by the seaside. So something that happened. And then one thing that's absolutely critical, and this makes the British arcade completely different from an American one or an Australian one or a European one, mm-hmm. was that in 1960, after there'd been suggestions of infiltration of the then illegal gambling machines. So in the 1950s, gambling machines were all throughout the UK. Gambling was illegal. But mm-hmm. it was also socially accepted. So people engaged in gambling, low stakes gambling, but it was strictly illegal. The police force were concerned about the enforcement of the rules and the laws because they were so socially unpopular. And essentially each policeman or police force was given local jurisdiction to make a decision about whether to enforce or not enforce any gambling issues. In around 1950, in America, gambling law changed, and it meant that gambling machines couldn't travel across state borders. And so with the massive contraction of opportunities for gambling in the United States, Americans decided that Britain was the place to go. And so essentially a lot of American, criminals, I guess, became involved in England, and the British government became very, very concerned, and they introduced a law that, and this might sound counterintuitive, they introduced a law that legalized low-stakes gambling for everyone in England.
Okay.
So this meant that children could then legally gamble. It meant that anyone could legally gamble, but at certain levels of gambling. The other things that this law did, it regulated and controlled the machines. So essentially criminal elements could not be involved in the operation of these machines. But for the sand dancers, these arcade owners, this gave them an opportunity to make enormous amounts of money. They could now use low-stakes gambling machines like penny pushers or converted gambling machines. Yeah. To make a backbone of investment that then became the underpinning foundations for the future growth of the arcade. So there's a load of different things going on, but essentially those are the key points. You know, you've got the traveling showman, you've got the 1960 Gaming Act, and yeah, you've got the profusion of machines and issues with legality and gambling.
And then continuing from there, your fifth chapter is called Pings, Pongs, and Pioneers, which is really, I love it, yeah. It details the arrival of video games in Britain. It also highlights the already global and connected nature of the British amusement arcade industry. And let's deep dive into these kickoff points in arcade history, or younger arcade history then.
Yeah. So if you think at this point, we're in the, In the late 1960s, the British amusement arcade has grown enormously. So the income that's been made through that 1960 Gaming Act has meant that everyone has bought up all the old cinemas, all the old theatres around the British coast. Mm-hmm. They've set up these arcades. They're awash with tourists because the holiday industry is booming in Britain. And it's a good time. People are making lots and lots of money. Now, interestingly, the laws change that there's less control given to seaside arcades than inner city arcades. Mm-hmm. And so it's an absolute boom time. Yeah. What happens as well is that a number of manufacturers in England, such as Mayfield Electronics, Streets of Eastbourne, begin making games for the arcades. And I should say Crompton's, a very important manufacturer. Mm-hmm. And they're making, at this point, electromechanical games. So they're maybe shooting games where you're shooting electronic tanks or mechanical tanks and things like that, or they're penny pushers or they're gambling machines. So there's this culture of copying and making games. Now, let me just check my notes. I think it's, can I even see my notes? So here we are. So we've got the late 60s.
Yeah.
And there's also a trade show. There are several trade shows around England. And so it becomes really quite a buoyant place for games. Now, in 1969, a chap called Martin Bromley, who you're probably familiar with the company that he set up, Sega, his company was sold to Gulf and Western. So Martin Bromley earned, you know, millions and millions of dollars through selling his company. After a couple of years, he gets a bit bored and he wants to get back into the arcade industry. And he sees Britain as being the most affluent, the most prosperous arcade location to go to. And so he essentially bankrolls a company called Alka, who were based in Oldham in northern England. Mm-hmm. And at this point, the arcade industry is very much based around London and the southeast. So it being based in northern England is quite important because it can serve the huge population of arcades and travelling showmen who are in the other part of the country. Anyway, you want to talk about video games. So what happened was that Martin Bromley arranged for some meetings between some really important people in the games industry at that time in England. So we've got David Green, who was the head of Associated Leisure at the time. He was perhaps the best arcade salesman in the country. We've got Jeff Ellis, who was an engineer at a company called Mayfield, who was considered the very best at making and copying electromechanical games. And we've got Martin Bromley, this multi-millionaire, slightly shady character who has controlled the entire kind of arcade industry, well, across the globe, really, since the Second World War. And what he does is he creates a company called Alka to make more games and make electronic games. And he just happens to have arranged a meeting and connected all these people together at a perfect time. Now, there's a trade show in October 1972 where Nolan Bushnell shows Pong. Mm-hmm. And Pong is seen at this trade show in England. And David Green has, by this point, accepted the position as the head of Alka alongside Jeff Ellis as the chief engineer. And when he's at this meeting, at this trade fair even, he's so impressed by the game that he wants to get it. Now, he talks apparently to Sam Stern, the owner of Stern Pinball, who says that everyone in America is about to make this game and copy this game. And David Green is essentially given the tip-off of the factory that makes these Pong games. Oh. And the very next day, he flies to America and he goes to this factory. And the factory agrees to sell him 300 of these boards that he then brings back to the UK. Apparently, he pays $150 for each one, which was a huge amount of money at the time. Mm-hmm. He comes back with these 300. And Alka produce Ping Pong. Now, this game beats Atari to the British market by almost 4 months. Mm. And that's the first video game in the UK. So that's an example of the kind of thing that was happening. But there's lots of things happening at this time like that.
Mm. That's really, it's like a crime story almost. No, it's not a crime, but it's really suspenseful, of course.
Yeah, It wasn't a crime at the time. So what you've got to understand is that copyright wasn't really established within, within these digital games yet. Although, of course, Pong wasn't really a digital game. It was using other components. Mm-hmm. But it's more to do with the way the industry had developed. And it had developed in a way where objects, things were the thing. Data was never the thing that made sense to them. So they always, the manufacturers were quite accustomed to copying each other's designs, improving them and refining them. So this might have felt slightly against the, against the rules of behavior, but it wasn't really seen as being completely against the law. And also, when I spoke to David Green before he died in 2019, he said that nobody that he spoke to ever thought that this would be anything more than just a blip, just an interesting game for maybe 6 months. He didn't think it was the start of a genre or a way of playing. So that was why they thought it was no big deal.
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea of a genre, it seems so very natural to us right now, and the players, of course, and the audience. But the idea of a video game genre, that's really something interesting. When it first started, there were no genres as we speak of, right?
Yeah, that's right. And the manufacturers also didn't understand the game or how it worked. So Alka, quite famously, the first games that they sold out, you know, their first 300 ping pongs, they didn't know how to fix them. They didn't know how they worked. They didn't even really know how to shield the boards. Mm-hmm. And so I interviewed one chap who suggested that every time a police van would drive past his pub that had a Alka ping pong in, the game would reset because it was so poorly shielded that the interference would cause problems with the game. So this was really new territory for them, and they were just following the innovation from America, really, at this point.
Yeah. So you were already talking a bit about the copyright law, and in your sixth chapter, you combine this aspect with something now very familiar, at least I think so, to our listeners, because you also discuss the British arcade crash of 1982, and maybe you can tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. Now, for a long while, I was in denial that there was ever an arcade crash mm-hmm. in England, because we didn't have the kind of the scorched earth tales you heard from North America, where every arcade shut down and everything was kind of almost finished. Or, you know, we didn't have that kind of apocalyptic arcade experience. But what we had was that video games became completely unprofitable in the arcade. But because of the investment that had been made, because of the income that could be made from the British arcades, because of their embracing of low stakes gambling and things like that, it wasn't terminal. It just meant that the arcades changed their focus for a few years, and then they changed again. But if you think that arcades have been around in England from about 1880, or if you read Nick Costa's latest book, he would suggest even earlier than that, about 1840, mm-hmm. what's happened is these arcades have just changed the games that they'd offered to the public. So that was quite a normal thing. But yeah, the question about copyright is very interesting. So skipping back really to the time of Alka, so relatively soon what happened was that people started copying these machines. You know, Rudolf, if you wanted to, if we were in the late 70s or the early 80s, you and I could agree over a pint of beer or a cup of tea or something like that, we could agree to set up an arcade manufacturing company. We could decide to manufacture video games. all we would need was, you'd need to have a friend who made kitchen cabinets. I'd need to know someone who could sell us some arcade boards. I wouldn't care where they came from. And we might have to find a bunch of televisions or maybe some monitors if we really felt like spending money. And that would be it. We would become a company. We could call that game whatever we really wanted.
Very tempting, and very tempting, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's essentially what happened. So the kind of the British, or in fact the global market at that point in time, very quickly got saturated by people making games, people calling games different names. And then you also had the additional layers of manufacturers or factories making an extra 25% of an order and then selling them on the black market. Or you had people fiddling around with the boards and editing them and changing them, making their own versions of games. And you had direct copies as well. So very quickly, the notion of copyright became really problematic because the manufacturers of the games were losing money. So Sega, Williams, companies like that became increasingly litigious and increasingly bothered by what was happening. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you know, Rudolph and Allen's arcade company, you know, there were companies like that all around the country. And if you wanted to buy an arcade machine, you could buy one, put it in your pub or your cafe or in your arcade, and you could try and make money from it. But what happened was you started getting reduced incomes because the public saw lots of games. There were too many games for the public to pay. Mm-hmm. The quality of the games was variable, and the manufacturers and the distributors stopped making money. So the crash was more that the distributors decided to stop importing games and selling them because it simply wasn't worth their while. But there's a really interesting chap who appears at this point in time, a person called John Richards. Mm-hmm. And John Richards was a DJ, a disc jockey. So he used to basically play music in some of the clubs that were frequented by the arcade industry. In fact, he played at a number of arcade industry kind of Christmas events and things like that. And he's really interesting because he is a self-taught electronics expert. And he found, through his contacts, essentially a load of broken Alka ping pong games and other early boards. And he was able to very quickly understand what had gone wrong with them and fix them, even though people in the industry at the time didn't know how to fix them.
Yeah.
And he developed a company with that expertise where he essentially would take these games and he would modify them and edit them and then sell them on. He would also do repairs and people would pay him to do them. And then a little bit later on, he made his own versions of games, either using slightly modified hardware or hardware that he's created from scratch. And essentially, he does things like a horizontal version of Breakout that he calls Breakthrough. Mm. And just makes lots and lots of stuff. Now, I think he's just an example of a really intelligent kind of entrepreneur and pioneer. Yeah. But as the years go on, he gets involved directly in copying, and there are examples of copyright infringement. So if we fast forward to the early 80s, so 1981, 1982, globally the arcade board manufacturers are in trouble. They're losing money left, right, and center, and what they need is some kind of legal control or protection. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that John Richards and his company becomes the focus for a legal case, a case that goes into the High Court all about this. So I think it's in May 1981, there's a case in America between Cinematronics and Sutra West. It's about a game called Star Castle. Mm-hmm. And it establishes that in America, copyright applies to the code on the chips on the arcade boards. Yeah. And that means that anyone tampering with them or copying them is in breach of the law. And then shortly afterwards, what happens is that this John Richards, who's quite a, he's not antagonistic, but he's kind of a countercultural person. He entered into an interesting, protracted argument with Sega, mm-hmm, in the National Arcade Press. So every week he would put in an argument, and there'd be a reply from Vic Leslie, who is the Sega representative. And then there'd be a backwards and forth between them. And in the end, Sega took John Richards to court over copyright infringement on Frogger. And John Richards decided to self-defend himself at the High Court. And eventually he lost. So even though he was saying that the 1956 British Copyright Act applied and therefore he was able to do what he wanted, he failed at the High Court and copyright applied to video games. Now, he's told me actually that he was quite happy to defend it. He never really thought that the defence would happen and that his stance would be upheld. But it was just that the business was so lucrative at that point in time that it was preferable for him to keep this going for another year or another 9 months to go all the way to the High Court. And then he knew that the copying games days would be over. Mm. Of course, this didn't end there. There was still copying happening all around the globe. And this became a protracted issue for the entire industry. But probably most important for the discussion we've had, ultimately, that copyright law with John Richards killed Alka, you know, that company started by Martin Bromley. Because what happened was that Alka apparently had bought one board of Frogger in February 1982 and made 100 copies and put it in the machines that they ran in different pubs and cafes, desperate to try and make money. Yeah. And then that was uncovered. It was all illegal. Martin Bromley pulled his funding and the company went belly up. So that was the impact of all of that.
Mm. Would be also the end of our little company, right?
Mm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Sorry. It's been great working with you.
Right. Yeah. The best times. Yeah. Now, chapter 7, called The Invader's Revenge, what a great title again, is maybe my favorite chapter. You focus on the development of relationships between the Japanese and British video game industries, and it's really a fantastic read. And maybe I thought we can also combine your thoughts here with the 9th chapter, Sega World Street Fighter, Street Fighter 1 and exporting games to Japan.
Crikey, yeah, a lot to cover. But yeah, let's try and do that. So I've painted a pretty bleak and, if I'm honest, slightly myopic reading of the arcade industry, because mm-hmm. this is the issue. When you're trying to tell a story that hasn't been told before, you have to omit certain things, you have to simplify certain structures. And it's a bit of a problem. So while all that other stuff was happening, you also had people that understood how to do business and how to forge kind of partnerships with international partners. Mm-hmm. And one company is Electrocoin. And Electrocoin are a company that's still in business now. And Electrocoin are essentially the company that stabilized all of these problems within the British market and did an awful lot to stabilize the European and global markets, actually. And if there's kind of any accusation of bias in my book, it would be that a character called John Stagides, who's the managing director of Electrocoin, comes out as a bit of a hero in the story because he's the person that managed to work all the way through these ups and downs mm-hmm. as quite a visible and vocal member of the arcade community, but also one that forged really strong links with Japanese manufacturers and essentially ushered the later stages of the arcade for Britain. So just to give you an idea, mm-hmm. The largest kind of distributor of video games in the early 80s was a company called Associated Leisure. And that was the company that Michael Green had worked for a number of years. But Associated Leisure essentially had enormous buying power. They could treat manufacturers with almost with contempt, to be honest, because they almost had the monopoly on the market.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And in the early 80s, they formed an agreement with Universal, so Universal Games of Japan, and they apparently arranged for a number of video games to be brought over. So it would have been the Cosmic Monsters games, so the Cosmic series of shoot 'em ups. And apparently when the delegation arrived in England, there was no one from Associated Leisure to meet them. They ignored the phone calls. And essentially, the people from Associated Leisure decided no longer to go ahead with that deal. And that's pretty shoddy business behaviour. Whether or not it's really true or not is questionable. But essentially what happened was that these businessmen from Universal Games ended up by chance going to an arcade in London that was owned by John Stagides and was owned by Electrocoin, at which point John Stagides said that he would take on the order that had been dropped by Associated Leisure. And through this act of, principle and fair trading essentially built really strong links with this company. So Electrocoin after that became the single license exporter for Universal Games, and then John Stajidi's reputation with the Japanese developers grew, and then he would go out to Japan and he forged links with Capcom, and essentially all of the bad business practices, John Stajidi's and Electrocoin became people that regulated and kind of standardized the market. Now, John Stajidi suggested that the number of games being imported should be reduced. He would go out and he would advise the Japanese developers of how to change games for a European market, mm-hmm. and essentially started to take control and urge a certain degree of calm within the market. So when people were saying about the death of the video game industry, Electrocoin and John Stajidis were saying, no, we just need to reduce our imports. We need to be very careful about the quality of games and sort things out. So I probably haven't answered your question, but that's very important background kind of information. So ask me some more, because I've slightly lost the plot.
Yeah, how does this all fit together with the enormous success story of future success story? Because as soon as I was reading Street Fighter, of course, I thought, well, that's it. That's a certain milestone. I would like to hear and learn more about this and the interconnections.
Yeah, okay, that's good. You got me back on track. So apart from my love for John Stajidis that I've just been expressing, I grew up in the arcades in the late 1980s. So the games that I loved and I looked at were, Street Fighter II, Final Fight, Ghouls and Ghosts, Bubble Bobble. I might play something like Operation Wolf. But many, many of these games were distributed by Electrocoin, including Street Fighter. So what happened was that through this very careful, rather vociferous kind of trading with Japan, so for instance, John Stajidis, he complained about JAMA, the Japanese amusement arcade trading organization. Mm-hmm. He said that their business practices were toxic to the European industry, and he urged them to engage in some kind of regulation of their business practices, something that they did. And Electrocoin and Stajidis ended up entering into partnership with Capcom as well. So that era of video games that I loved was essentially a product of that early partnership with Universal and that continued very, very sincere, very, very clear business dealing. And one of the products of it was Street Fighter. So Street Fighter 2 entered into the arcades in, it would have been early 1991. And at that point, British amusement arcades had changed again. What had happened was that video games had diminished. They became fewer and fewer. And by that, I mean an individual video game on an arcade cab. Instead, what we had was an increasing number of driving cabs and driving machines, because video games became increasingly expensive. And so arcade owners thought it was better to invest in bigger machines that lasted for longer. Also, the Japanese yen was increasing in value, and it was making imports increasingly difficult. Anyway, Street Fighter 2 arrives and the game completely changes. So if you went to an arcade in the early 1990s, so certainly by 1992, you would see bank after bank after bank of Street Fighter games. Hmm. For instance, the arcade that I went into had three copies of Street Fighter 2. They had them on these special sit-down arcade machines made by Electrocoin. They're called Electrocoin Duets, so you could sit next to someone and you could play them, a bit like a candy cab. And Street Fighter 2 was everywhere. It became a problem that Electrocoin started testing out Street Fighter 2 in arcades in central London, and the police had to be involved to move the crowds away. And then, of course, Electrocoin used that as an opportunity to advertise their game, apologising to all the people in London for being obstructed by the popularity of Street Fighter 2. Yeah. But Street Fighter 2 was a complete cultural shift or a cultural moment. So we also had lots and lots of copies of Street Fighter 2. So for instance, when I would go to school in the morning, we would go past the chip shop, and at lunchtime we would go to the chip shop and we'd have a portion of chips, and then we would play a dodgy version of Street Fighter 2, Street Fighter 2 Rainbow Edition, and then Street Fighter 2 Black Belt Edition, that were essentially modified hacks of the game that were just excellent to play. But Street Fighter 2 became a kind of a cultural motif for us, and the arcades were very, very busy, and it ushered kind of a second age, or perhaps a third age, of video games in the arcade. So yeah, loads of stuff. This was through very close relationship between Japanese manufacturers and British distributors. And this extended even further, that at a certain point, the yen became so expensive, so valuable, that Japanese manufacturers made their games in the UK and then exported them back to Japan. It was cheaper to do that. And so think about the Japanese view of arcades was on some level influenced by the British market and the European market by extension. And Sega decided that part of their grand vision of the future of the arcade was to bring a Japanese family entertainment model to England. And they created an enormous arcade in Trocadero. Mm-hmm. Very strangely, so Trocadero is an area, it's a big building in central London. And they created an enormous amusement park and arcade on top of perhaps the second largest arcade already in Britain. So we have this very, very strange thing. They invest a colossal amount of money. So this isn't just an arcade. This has I think it's six different rides, including go-karts. You could fire balls at other go-karts and it tallies scores. All kinds of stuff, enormous investment. And it's a complete critical and commercial failure. It closes within 4 years of being released, and It shows kind of the end of the Japanese vision of arcades in other countries. So lots of really overlapping stuff. But what you get in this period is a very close relationship between Japanese arcade manufacturers, Japanese video game manufacturers, and the British market.
I almost was tempted to ask whether this magical place still exists, but this would have spoiled it. But then you did. Oh, no, my utopia, it's gone.
Yeah, weirdly, I never went to Sega World. It's one of my regrets. I've got a Sega World brochure, but I never went there. So, oddly, what happened was that Sega World, when it started closing down, because it was built over multiple levels, mm-hmm. and the arcade that was underneath it, Funland, ended up buying or leasing floors of Sega World. It was almost like it cannibalized it back. It was quite an interesting thing to think about afterwards. So yeah, Sega World came and failed, and then the arcade expanded to take over bits of Sega World. So no, I'm afraid it doesn't exist. But apparently, it was a fantastic arcade. Yeah. It had the very best machines from Sega there.
Yeah. Well, we are entering the final round, or shall I say stage? So this is where I'd like to ask my guests for a little meta reflection. What aspects and ideas would you have loved to include in your book that did not make the cut? And secondly, and I'm really excited to ask that one, where do you see game studies as a research field in general at the moment?
Yeah, thank you. Okay. Well, yeah. So I said earlier on that I never really intended to write this book. I wanted to tell a different book about people first and foremost and the way that they played. And I think that really I'd still quite like to do that. I think that the thing I'd like to express is kind of the character, you know, the entrepreneurial nature of many of these people, the ways that people played in arcades, and say something that's slightly less historical and mm-hmm. and speaks more about the played experience of being in arcades. And then who knows, there are some larger than life characters that I've encountered and learned about and I've seen in the historical record. And I just think there are so many more stories, perhaps more interesting stories in a way, that could be told. And so, yeah, I've been toying with the idea of, a historical film, like a historical fiction about arcades or something like that. But essentially, there are lots of potential things that can be done and should be done, really, and that I couldn't do in that book. So I'm still toying with it. But, I think there'll be more things. And as for, where do I see game studies as a field? Well, frankly, game studies is, for me, enormous. It's so enormous. Mm-hmm. It's so diverse. So I was at DIGRA, the DIGRA conference this year, and I was just struck by there seems to be a track for almost any kind of subfield or sub-discipline or area. And so I would imagine it's quite intimidating for new scholars because it is so large. It's so encompassing. But I think it's absolutely fascinating because of that kind of richness and breadth, in the sense that you can talk to scholars about almost any field, any kind of area of specialism, and yet you can relate it back to your lived experiences through play and through game. So I think that game studies is in a really rich and interesting place at the moment. I guess it probably is going to break up into a number of different subfields, but it's so rich and so interesting that I'm thrilled to be a part of it. What do you think?
Well, it's a classic question in a way, because game studies seems to be caught between the status of being an interdisciplinary field of research and somehow striving for becoming an own discipline, right? At least in Germany, we don't have the particular or specific institutions nor the lectureships. There's no financial backup, but we can clearly see that there is a huge interest from all kinds of fields, but it just it's not far enough, or maybe it's even not the model of the future to strive for an stronger institutionalization there, but for younger scholar or even say students, of course you can write your bachelor thesis or your master thesis, but what next? Because there are no real lectureships for this kind of work. I think we have maybe two or three who are colleagues who are really who actually work in this field 24/7, but even their denomination is not really called game studies. So difficult, but on the other hand, we can see what's especially interesting to me, this that the way journalism is dealing with the topic has diversified enormously. So they keep especially the sort of cultural, feuilletonistic approach to these topics. And they're going to keep asking questions that are also questions for academic game studies. So maybe this is this type of alliance or form of connection is something that can initiate a new growth for the academic side as well. We have to see, I guess.
You've got fantastic conferences, though, haven't you? So, I love Amaze. Amaze, I think, is just one of the most fantastic kind of most events going.
I mean, they had it hard like everyone else during the pandemic now, but I think they're getting back on track. And I know lots of these people. They're really on fire. They live this, and I hope they have the success. It's not given, but it's definitely earned.
I guess I'd quite like to see DIGRA becoming slightly more like a maze, or some kind of melding of the practice and the experimentation alongside game studies and the research. I think things become much more rich through interdisciplinarity, really. I'd love to see more of that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this brings me to our final point. Alan, what are you working on right now? And of course, what will you be playing next?
Oh, good questions. Well, who knows what I'm going to be working on? So at the moment, I'm working on a digital recreation of the 1980s British arcade, of course. So we've created two arcades from a place called Herne Bay, so a little bit round from where I live. in Unreal Engine 5, and you can walk around a relatively accurate 1980s British arcade. You can then walk outside and go next door into a bingo arcade. And if you're really interested, you can look at a machine, you can press a button, and my dulcet tones will appear as I explain the game and the kind of the cultural context. Now, that's going to be exhibited at Somerset House in London as part of London Design Biennial. Cool. And we're now in talks with, I don't know if I should say, we're in talks with a major cultural thing to do
yeah,
a similar kind of project about something slightly more important, according to most people, than arcade. So potentially we'll do something a bit like the Walden game, but for something important in England. But I can't say what that is. That's just happening right now.
Yeah.
And then aside from that, who knows? I do quite fancy the idea of making a kind of a historical fiction, or maybe writing a television series. I do like the idea of some kind of arcade television series, you know, something somewhere between Peaky Blinders and The Sopranos and,
oh,
I don't know, Boardwalk Empire. But who knows?
Who knows?
Rudolph, who knows what the plan is?
I mean, these all sound like really great projects. So I want to thank you for being on the show today, and I really enjoyed it. And before my last goodbye is coming on air, if people want to follow you on Twitter, is there anything or any platform in specific you like to be followed?
God, this is very strange, isn't it? I'm probably the only person who will say, you know, I don't really do social media, but people can reach out and they can email me or they can come find me. Mm-hmm. But I would say probably the best thing to do is to, email me, find me online and email me,
right,
while I'll find out how to set up a Twitter account, things like that.
It's okay. So thank you again. Take care and goodbye, Alan.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, dear listeners, I hope you liked this episode. If you are an author and or an editor in the field of game studies or game research yourself and want to talk about your latest publication, please do not hesitate to contact me under rudolf.indust@googlemail.com. Alternatively, please send me a direct message on social media. You will find me under Rudolf Indust almost everywhere. And now, see you in a bit.